Where do you find wisdom? Does it reside in a university? It's an interesting possibility. If you say yes to that, then the next question would be, which professor? Because if you've ever been to a university, you know they disagree with each other. So if it's in the university, which professor does it reside in? Or you might say that there's wisdom in books. And of course, the answer would provoke another question. If wisdom is in books, which book? And how do you know which book has true wisdom and which only pretends to have wisdom that really isn't? If you seek for wisdom, you might come to the conclusion that it's even unavailable. Is that true? Well, Job discusses that very question. Now, if you've been tracking me as we've been going through the book of Job, you know that he had these incredible problems from head to toe, and three friends show up, and they all tell him that the problem with his life is that he has sinned, and all these problems have come as a result. And he, of course, rejects all of that. Those conversations are now over. At the beginning of them, Job gave a speech. At the end of them, Job gives another speech. These are soliloquies, so to speak. They sort of act as bookends to that whole huge section that deals with the three friends of Job. So what we're going to look at is a speech given by Job that's not exactly directed toward his friends, that's over, and deals with the subject of wisdom. And what he does is he asks the question, where does it come from? Where is it to be found? So will you turn with me to Job chapter 28? We're going to look at this one chapter, the subject of which is wisdom and where it is found. I must say that this is one of the most fascinating chapters in the book of Job that we've looked at so far. A couple of those opening chapters are really fascinating, but this chapter maybe just needs to be a standalone. What Job says here is just excellent and needs to be digested by every believer in Jesus Christ. I found this chapter very simple and very profound all at the same time. So let's look at it. It's naturally divided into three parts. And in those three parts, Job makes three points. Now, if that isn't tailor-made for a Baptist preacher, I don't know what is. The first thing he does in verses 1 to 11 is he makes the point that human beings, man, mines metals. And the point of view seems to be that this is an extraordinary thing, that given the day in which he lived, that a man could dig into the earth to find gold or silver or some other metal was simply an extraordinary achievement. So in these first 11 verses, that's all he does. He just says, man can mine metals. That's a mouthful, isn't it? For example, look at verse 1. He says, surely there is a mine of silver and a place where gold is refined. In other words, man is able to mine silver and gold. He's able to penetrate into the earth and bring out those metals. Then he says in verse 2, iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man is able to take iron ore from the earth and smelter copper ore from it, or form it, ore from it. So in those first two verses, it's just very clear, he's saying man mines metals. Now, he's going to discuss in the next several verses, he does this by digging mines. So he says in verse 3, man puts an end to darkness and searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadow of death. In other words, man puts an end to darkness by carrying a torch into the mines, which are so dark. They are like a shadow of death. So this verse is simply saying he puts an end to the darkness by carrying this light with him so he can see. Verse 4, he breaks open a shaft away from the people. In places forgotten by feet, they hang far away from men. They swing to and fro. This verse is a little difficult. There are just a whole lot of explanations of exactly what's going on here. Matter of fact, one commentator says, few passages in the Bible are more obscure. Trying to figure out exactly what he's saying is not easy. However, having said all that, it seems to me there's no doubt that Job is talking about mining. He uses the word shaft. The obscurity may possibly arise from the fact that mining operations were conducted in a manner different from the way they are now. And that may be the reason we have such a difficulty with this verse. Man makes a mining shaft away from where people dwell, that is, away from the surface on the ground, in a place where their feet have no support. So the idea seems to be that man descends into this mine shaft by means of something like a swinging basket. And that's the meaning of the little phrase, to and fro. At any rate, the context is very clearly about man descending into a mine shaft. So he says in verse 5, as far as the earth, from it comes bread, but beneath it is turned up as by fire. In other words, from the top of the earth comes grain from which we make bread. From beneath the earth come stones that glow like coals of fire. Again, he's simply saying man mines metals. Verse 6, its stones are the source of sapphires, and it contains gold dust. The stones of the earth are the source of sapphires, and the earth contains gold dust. Now, at this point, he seems to be saying that these mine shafts go where birds cannot see. In verse 7, that path no bird knows, nor has the falcon's eye seen it. In a shaft, birds do not go there. Man does, but birds don't. He then says animals do not go there in verse 8. The proud lions have not trodden it, nor lest the fierce lion pass over it. A miner goes where proud, fierce lions do not go. And that's my point when I say he seems to be saying, look at what man can do. He can do what birds can't do, what animals can't do. He goes where darkness is and he takes a light. He does this incredible thing of digging a mine shaft. He says one more thing in these 11 verses. He says, man does this where it's hard to go. Look at verse 9. He puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at its root. Its roots. A miner approaches the hardest substance, like flint, searching for precious stones. The overturning of the root of the mountains is the base of the mountain. That is, he digs under the mountain, and if he digs too much, the mountain falls. It says in verse 10, he cuts out channels in the rock, and his eyes see every precious thing. In the process of mining, the miner cuts channels from the water to flow through the rocks, and he sees every precious stone that lies embedded in the rocks. So he concludes in verse 11, he dams up the streams from trickling. What is hidden he brings forth to light. The miner dams up the streams of water that trickle down the side of the shaft. He brings out the hidden treasures, such as gold. So the point of these 11 verses is simply this. The miner searches for metals underground, including silver, gold, copper, iron, and precious gems such as sapphires. He digs shafts in the dark underground where birds with keen sight cannot see and animals do not go. He does what is difficult and brings hidden things to light, all in search of wealth. One commentator summed it all up like this. He said, the structure of the passage is getting valuable metals from the earth by going underground, unseen by people, getting valuable metals and gems from the earth, unseen by birds and animals, by going underground and getting valuable metals from the earth. So that really sort of sums it up. Now, from Job's point of view, at the time he lived, he chose mining and said, it's incredible what man can do. Let me pause here before we look at the rest of the chapter and let me imagine that Job lived today. What would he say that's parallel to this? Well, I would suggest that man knows many more times than man did when Job was around. As a matter of fact, in 2013, a man named David Russell Sterling wrote, and I quote, Buckminster Fuller created the knowledge doubling curve. He noticed that until 1900, human knowledge doubled approximately every century. By the end of World War II, knowledge was doubling every 25 years. Today, things are not as simple as different types of knowledge, that things aren't as simple because different types of knowledge have different rates of growth. For example, nanotechnology knowledge is doubling every 2 years and clinical knowledge every 18 months. But on average, human knowledge is doubling every 13 months. According to IBM, now this is written in 2013, according to IBM, the building out of the internet thing will lead to the doubling of knowledge every 12 hours. So you can just imagine what we would say instead of mining, how about landing on the moon or some such thing? Now let me give you another example. In 1970, when Apollo 13 got lost in space, it took NASA computers 90 minutes to work a way out to bring back the communication. A scientist working with a pencil and a piece of paper would have taken over 1 million years to figure out how to accomplish the same thing. So I looked at this passage and I thought about just knowledge doubling and every so often, and we got so much more knowledge you can't even... It gives you a headache to try to even think about it. And then I thought, well, you know, the greatest illustration is in my hand. Now, just think about what you can do with an iPhone. This is an incredible little instrument. I mean, look at that thing. That thing's not very big. It fits in my pocket, my shirt pocket. Look at that. Now, let me tell you what I can do with this. I have access to knowledge. Not a set of encyclopedias, libraries. I can get on the internet with this thing, and there's just about nothing you can't find. As a matter of fact, I don't even have to type it in. I can just talk to it and tell it to go do something, and it'll go do it. It'll find it. Matter of fact, I did that. I was talking with a fellow this afternoon.
Here's what I found on the web.
I pushed the button and she talked back to me. I was talking with somebody. I was actually in a counseling situation with a fella, and he had one of those old flip phones. And I pulled it out and I asked this a question, a technical question I needed to know about giving him some financial advice. And he apparently he had never seen this, and he said, you can do that with a phone? Now, needless to say, by that story, you know how old he was. He was not a young man. But just think about this. As a matter of fact, let me tell you, there I have an app on here called YouVersion. It's a Bible app. And in that app, I have over 1,000 Bibles in 770 languages. Can you imagine that? You see this little thing that's in my hand? I'm holding 1,000 Bibles. I have a hard enough time with one. 1,000 Bibles in 770 languages. But the thing that boggles my mind constantly is an app called Waze. How many of you know about Waze? W-A-Z-E. You know about Waze? Let me tell you what Waze does. I can tell this phone, give me directions to my house. I give it the address, and it'll actually take me there. I mean, that's built into iPhone. It'll give me directions. Go down Lindley, turn left on Burbank, get to White Oak, turn right, exit 101 South. And it'll tell me everything to do. Waze does it real time. I turn Waze on, and it tells me there are 2,000 other people plugged in between here and my house. And it sends all of their speeds, I think, up to a satellite. And then it tells me, it talks to me. Matter of fact, I can choose the voice I want to listen to. And somehow, on its own, it changed voices to me. And my wife heard it the other day. Where'd you get him? And so I went into settings, and I picked the gal that was much more pleasant to listen to. And I found out I could even have Elvis talk to me. But what's amazing is, if on my way home, the route that you would normally go is plugged up because of an accident or heavy traffic, it'll take me down another route, real time. It will tell me at the beginning of the trip when I'm going to arrive and how many miles it is, and it to the minute. It is uncanny. And every time I use it, I say, how did they do that? So that's the spirit of what's going on in these 11 verses. Job is saying it's incredible what man can do, and he uses digging a mine shaft as an illustration. So man can do some phenomenal things, flying to the moon and putting 1,000 Bibles in my hand in a little bitty space. All right? Next section of Job 28, in verses 12 to 19, he then says, but let me tell you what man cannot do. He cannot find wisdom. So, look at verse 12. He says, but where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? So now he's going to focus in on just the subject of wisdom. So very clearly, just a cursory reading of the passage, it's obvious that he shifts gears, he turns a corner, and instead of discussing mining metals out of the earth, he's now going to discuss where can we go find wisdom. Verse 13, man does not know its value. Oh boy, is that the understatement of the day. Nor is it found in the land of the living. Man does not comprehend the value of wisdom. It's not found among human beings. Now, you got to put these two passages in juxtaposition, in contrast to each other. Man can do these phenomenal things, but when it comes to wisdom, he can't find wisdom. Verse 14, the deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. You're not going to find wisdom in the depth of the earth or by traveling the sea. Man can dig into the earth and sail the sea, traveling to the ends of the earth, but man will never find wisdom in those places. So he starts this section by saying, man is not going to find wisdom. Now he says, neither can you buy it. Look at verse 15. It cannot be purchased with gold nor silver, be weighed for its price. Very simply, wisdom cannot be purchased with silver and gold. The Hebrew word for gold, by the way, is not the usual word for gold. This Hebrew word means pure gold. It's the most precious gold. Some translations render it fine gold. Not with the most expensive gold, the most valuable gold, could you go by wisdom. He says, verse 16, it cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. The gold of Ophir is the ultimate, spoken of as the most precious kind of gold. It's more valuable than the most precious metals you can imagine. Verse 17, neither gold or crystal can equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewelry in fine gold. Wisdom is more valuable than gold, crystal, or jewelry made of fine gold. By the way, the crystal here probably notes something like rock crystal having a strong resemblance to a diamond. And then he says in this section, no mention shall be made of coral or quartz, for the price of wisdom is above rubies. Wisdom is more valuable than those metals. And finally, in verse 19, the topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. It's more valuable than topaz or pure gold. So, to sum up this little section, verses 12 to 19, Job is saying man cannot find wisdom which is more valuable than the most valuable precious metals. Wisdom cannot be purchased, nor is there an adequate price be placed upon it. Somebody has said, in spite of man's technological skills, he cannot find, unaided, the greatest treasures of all, wisdom. Its value is not fully known by man. He can discover other hidden treasures under the earth's surface, but he cannot discover wisdom in the inhabited earth, the land of the living, or in any ocean. Nor can wisdom be purchased in the market, in other precious, like with other precious metals. He simply cannot find wisdom. Now, I just find this most fascinating. On the one hand, in the first 11 verses, Job talks about these phenomenal things that man can do. The one thing is mining. We could add all kinds of things to that. And on the other hand, he then turns around and says, but no man can find wisdom. Man just can't do it. Man can find wisdom. Is that true? You believe that? I deliberately quoted somebody saying that knowledge doubles. I'm not saying man doesn't have knowledge. He has incredible knowledge. I'm saying he doesn't have wisdom. It's beyond his reach. Real wisdom people do not have. One of the commencement traditions at Harvard University is the senior class chapel. On the morning of their graduation, the seniors gather in Memorial Church to hear the minister offer words of encouragement as they leave, it's called the yard, to make their place in the world. In 1998, the senior class heard from the Reverend Peter Gomez, minister at Harvard and author of several books. Here's how he began. You're going to be sent out from here for good, and most of you aren't ready to go. The president is about to bid you into the fellowship of educated men and women. And, now he paused at this point, and he said every word very slowly. And you know just how dumb you really are. Now Imagine that. The senior class cheered in agreement. He continued, "And worse than that, the world, and your parents in particular, are going to expect that you are among the brightest and the best. But you know that you can no longer fool all the people, even some of the time. By noon today, you will be out of here. By tomorrow, you will be history. By Saturday, you will be toast. That's a fact. No exceptions, no extensions." End of quote. Can you imagine saying that to the seniors at Harvard and them cheering? Why? Because they know. They know. They don't know. Interesting. A minister, a Boy Scout, and a computer expert were the only passengers in a small plane. The pilot came back to the cabin and said the plane was going down and there was only 3 parachutes and 4 people. The pilot added, "I should have one of the parachutes because I have a wife and 3 small children." So he took one of the parachutes and jumped. The computer whiz said, "I should have one of the parachutes because I'm the smartest man in the world and everybody needs me." So he took one and jumped. The minister turned to the Boy Scout and said with a sad smile, "You are young and I've lived a rich life, so you take the remaining parachute and I will go down with the plane." The Boy Scout said, "Relax, Reverend. The smartest man in the world just picked up my knapsack and jumped out." When it comes to real wisdom, some of the smartest people in the world are some of the dumbest. May I repeat that? When it comes to real wisdom, I mean this very sincerely, some of the most brilliant people in the world are absolutely some of the dumbest. I recently talked to a man that was a member of Mensa. Do you know what that is? You have to be a genius to be a member of that. A certified genius. Did he have a lot of wisdom? I can tell you unequivocally, absolutely not. And it was very evident after talking to him for about an hour. He just wasn't as smart as he thought he was. When it comes to wisdom, some of the smartest people in the world can be absolutely stupid. And if you haven't figured that out yet, just live a little longer. It'll come home to you in spades. Now, I'm pressing the point because that's Job's point. Under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, Job is saying man can do some unimaginable things. But when it comes to wisdom, he doesn't have a clue. Now, that's the point of this passage. I started out saying, where is wisdom? Well, all we've discovered so far is it's not discoverable. So where do we find it? Well, that takes us to the third section of this chapter, and it consists of 8 verses. He begins by saying, wisdom is hidden. Verse 20. Again, he begins with a question, like he did in verse 12. From where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? If you'll remember, back in verse 12, he said, where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? This is clearly the subject and the question of this chapter. This time, he says in verse 21, it is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. It's hidden. That's his point in the verses 20 through 22. It's hidden. It's hidden from all humans. It's concealed from all animals. It's just like an unmined jewel. It's hidden. So he says in verse 22, destruction and death say, We have heard a report about it with our ears. Now, he's going to personify destruction. He's going to personify death as if they're human beings. And they say they do not know where wisdom is either. They've heard a report. It exists. But they don't know where it is either. So, where do you find wisdom? How would you like to know? Would you like to know where wisdom is? Read the next verse. Job 28:23. God understands its ways, and he knows its place. God knows the way of wisdom. He knows where it is. Job explains in verses 24 and 25, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heaven to establish a weight for wind and appropriation of water by measure. In other words, God sees everything. He sees to the ends of the earth and everything under the heavens. He sees the whole universe. God sees everything in order to weigh the wind and measure the water. He controls the elements of nature, like water and wind. So he says in verse 26, when he made a law for the rain and a path for the thunderbolt, then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it indeed. He searched it out. When, in the work of creation, he gave laws to rain and thunderstorms, when he weighed out the wind and measured out the water, then God saw and understood the principles of true wisdom. And to man, he said, and here's the bottom line, the last verse in the chapter, 28:28. If you miss everything else, get this. And to man, he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And departure from evil is understanding. You want to know where wisdom is? It's in the Lord. You want to know how to get it? This verse tells you. It's the fear of the Lord and the departure from evil. Now, we need to discuss the little expression, fear of the Lord. That's inseparably linked to wisdom in the book of Proverbs. When I went through the book of Proverbs some years ago, I bumped into it in chapter 1, verse 7, and it is so critical to the book of Proverbs, and for that matter, to many passages in the Old Testament, that I sat down and said, I got to figure out what's involved in this. Okay, you're not going to get very far without understanding the fear of the Lord. You hear the fear of the Lord, and you immediately think, well, you're scared to death, right? You're afraid. Is that what's involved? Well, we need to discuss that. After spending hours and hours digging around in this, I came to the conclusion there are three elements to the fear of the Lord, especially in the book of Proverbs. Number one, to fear the Lord is nothing more than to know the Lord. Now, let me prove that. Proverbs 9:10 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And knowledge, in that verse, a synonym for wisdom, of the Holy One is understanding. So he clearly says, by parallelism, that knowledge of the Holy One, knowing God, is the same thing as the fear of the Lord. As a matter of fact, and you've heard me say this before and you know this, that there are three Hebrew words for God, Elohim, Adonai, and there's a great debate as to how you pronounce the third one because the Jews didn't pronounce it, Yahweh or Jehovah. And God is used of false gods. God created the heavens and the earth. It's the powerful aspect of God. Adonai means Lord and could be used of a human being. But Yahweh is the word that's the personal name of God. It's his covenant relationship with his people. Well, the Jews didn't want to pronounce that, so they substituted Adonai for it. Now, the way you can tell the difference in an English translation is that if you see the word capital L, little O-R-D, that's Adonai. But if you see the word Lord in all capitals, that's the personal name of God. So the expression, the fear of the Lord, is all capitals. Embedded in the phrase is the idea that you have a personal relationship with the one of whom it is said that you fear. And of course, from the New Testament, we know that that comes through faith in Jesus Christ. And you, matter of fact, if I had the time, we could go to John 14. You ever heard preachers talk about you really want to know the Lord? You know, we talk about that all the time. How do you know the Lord? Well, there are verses in John 14 that say the way you know the Lord is you obey him. Verses 21 and 23. If you really want to know the Lord, I'm not talking about going to heaven. I'm talking about really getting to know him in an intimate way. It comes through obedience. John 14, verses 21 and 23, and you're looking those up now. You should write those down and look them up at home so you can listen to me. If I had time, we'd go through those. But so you just need to trust the Lord and you need to obey the Lord. And that's how you get to know the Lord. And that's embedded in this expression, the fear of the Lord. The second element is to reverence the Lord. The Hebrew word means to stand in awe, to reverence. Hence, part of the fear of the Lord is reverencing him. For example, Psalm 33, verse 8 says, "Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him." Did you hear that? Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. So by parallelism again, the fear of the Lord is standing in awe of him. So the first thing is to know him. The second thing is just to stand in awe, reverence him. And the third is be afraid of him. The word fear means fear. And there's no way to soften that. That doesn't mean terrified necessarily, unless you step out of line. And then you should fear the Lord. Matter of fact, this word can mean terrified. Unbelievers should be terrified of the judgment of God. And believers should fear when they don't please the Lord. So we use the expression, a God-fearing man. And what do we mean when we use that phrase? We're not talking about somebody over there trembling. We're talking about somebody that honors the Lord. And they're afraid to not please him. They step out of line. The illustration I used to use with teenagers, it's like a policeman. You shouldn't fear the policeman unless you're speeding. You should give him respect. And if you're speeding, then I think it's a good idea that you have a good, healthy dose of fear. So, true wisdom is fearing, showing holy respect and reverence for God. And back in chapter 28, verse 28 of Job, it's shunning evil. Someone has said the essence of wisdom is to fear the Lord and to depart from evil. That author is simply quoting Job 28:28. In the context of the book of Job, Job's accusers have insisted that he was not fearing God or hating sin, and therefore he was not wise. In this chapter, Job argues the opposite, that he is fearing God and hating evil. And they are not. Therefore, wisdom and understanding are his, not theirs. This closing verse also links the words to chapter 29, which we will look at next time. A moment ago, I quoted the chaplain at Harvard who gave the departing speech to the senior class. He goes on in that message to say after that shocking introduction. Quote, the future is God's gift to you. God will not let you stumble or fall. God has not brought you to this far, to this place, to abandon you or leave you here alone and afraid. The God of Israel never slumbers nor sleeps, never goes on sabbatical. Thus, my beloved and bewildered young friends, do not be afraid. So he ended that little chapel talk with the message that it was hope. There was hope. It wasn't all bleak. I would have said it, that part a little differently. I love the introduction. I would have said it very clearly. You want to know where wisdom is? Look at Job 28:28. Fear God, which means you got to know him and obey him. And fear him if you step out of line. And you eschew evil. So I began by asking the question, where is wisdom to be found? University? Books? No. Men can do many things, this chapter says, but he cannot find wisdom unless God reveals it to him. Wisdom is in the Lord. And if you don't know him, you do not know true wisdom. So let me sum all this up by making three very simple statements. Number one, the ultimate issue is wisdom. In the context of the book of Job, at the heart of the debate between Job and his three friends is the question, who is wise? I mentioned this a moment ago. Who has the correct insight into Job's suffering? Both Job and his friends set them up as sources of wisdom and ridicule the wisdom of the other. So the ultimate issue in this book, in a sense, is who's wise enough to understand why you are suffering? Now, that's the context of the book. That's one statement. But this chapter is telling us two things. Wisdom cannot be found by man. With his ingenuity, a miner unearths the treasures of the earth, but he cannot find wisdom. Man's remarkable success as a miner shows that he's clever and intelligent, but he fails to completely unearth wisdom. You cannot read this chapter without walking away with the inescapable conclusion. Man can do all kinds of interesting things, but he cannot find wisdom. And that leads me to my last and concluding thought. Wisdom comes from God. One commentator said, the point of Job's soliloquy is this. People have been extremely clever and clever in exploring, discovering, and extracting Earth's richest physical resources. Nonetheless, they have not been able to do so with what is even more essential to their welfare, namely wisdom. The reason for this is that wisdom does not lie hidden in the earth, but in the person of God. And I just thought that really said it well. So the chapter starts out by saying man can dig into the earth and find all kinds of very valuable stuff, but you can't find wisdom down there. Why? Because wisdom is in God, not in the earth. All right, so we know where wisdom is, right? But you knew that before you came, right? You would have probably said it's in the Bible, which isn't too bad. A lot of wisdom in the Bible. But let me ask you this. How would you like for me to tell you how you could possess wisdom? Raise your hand. Would you like to know how to find wisdom? All right, let me ask you this. If I tell you how to find it, I mean how to possess it, will you do what I tell you? If I can show it to you in the Bible, will you do it? All right. You asked for it. Here it comes. There are two things. They're both in Job. Number one, you must desire it. You must desire it. And let me quote you the verse that says that. In chapter 23, verse 12, Job said, I have not departed from the commandment of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. The day that you want the wisdom of God as much as you want food when you are hungry, that is the day you will be on your way to finding wisdom. And I'll go so far as to say, and until that day comes, you won't know as much wisdom as you could or should. So the first thing is you must desire it. And the second thing, and again, I don't have time to develop this extensively, but this is in other places in the Bible. You must not only desire it, but you must do it. You must do what God says. You do not have to be listed in who's who to know what's what. Matter of fact, just look at the first verse of Job. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and shunned evil. There it is, folks. First verse of the book. If you really want wisdom, you will have to desire it, and you will have to fear God and shun evil. As one has said, the key to obtaining that wisdom is orientating oneself properly toward God. Man fills his head with facts. He knows knowledge. God fills our hearts with wisdom when we obey him. All right. I ask, you want wisdom? You got to desire it, and you got to go do it. Now, James told us a long time ago, don't just be a hearer of the word, be a doer of the word. If you lack wisdom, ask God, and then he says you got to do it. So that's echoed again in James. But let me conclude by saying, of the two, which is more important? Desiring it or doing it? Well, if all you did was desire it without doing it, it wouldn't do you any good. But if you don't desire it, you won't do it. So there's a sense in which I want to end on the note, you really got to desire the book. I don't know how this happened. The Spirit of God, I guess. I don't guess. I think that's the answer. The day I became a Christian, I fell in love with this book. And I've spent my life digging into this book. And I can tell you what little bit of wisdom I have, which ain't much, came straight from the Lord in this book. I've spent every spare minute studying the book. It was my goal when I was 18 years old to go through every book of the Bible in minute detail. I don't know where this came from, but I have this great hunger to just know the book. And I think that's the key to this. You got to have that kind of hunger. I didn't plan to say that. It just came out. In his book, The Wonder of the Word of God, Robert Sumner tells about a man in Kansas City whose face was badly disfigured because of an explosion. He lost his eyesight and both hands. One of his greatest disappointments is that he could no longer read the Bible. Then he heard about a lady in England who read Braille with her lips. Hoping to do the same, he sent for the Bible in Braille. Much to his dismay, however, he discovered that the nerve endings of his lips had been destroyed by the explosion. Then one day, as he brought the Braille Bible page to his lips, his tongue happened to touch a few of the raised characters, and he could feel them with his tongue. That is when it occurred to him that he could read the Bible with his tongue. And when Sumner wrote that book, that man had read the entire Bible all the way through with his tongue 4 times. Now let me ask you, if you could only read the Bible with your tongue, do you desire it enough that that's what you would do? Or do you have enough desire to read it with the 2 eyes God gave you? Father, thank you for the wisdom that you've given us in your word. Thank you for the Spirit of God that illuminates our minds and gives us understanding. Lord, give us that hunger. As Paul said in Philippians, from you comes the desire to will and to do your good pleasure. Give us that desire that we hunger and thirst after righteousness and wisdom in your word. In Jesus' name, amen.